who weren't here last month. I'm Barbara Fleming. Obvious, it's kind of obvious because who else is standing up here taking a role? But since we already got your name, so I didn't even have to go through that. So, are there any administrative questions about how the class works or what to expect or whatever?
Jim, I meant to ask him, but he mentioned something about a test this morning.
Okay. So, if, and you know, all those initial handouts that you got, now that you're kind of in the swing of it, you could review those and read them carefully, and everything will make more sense. He was talking about, I believe, the certification exam. So if you've signed up and paid to be certified in cognitive therapy through the Cleveland Center for Cognitive Therapy, at the next, after next class in December, you'll be getting the first exam. You do not have to do it immediately. People have done theirs 20 years, literally 20 years late, but you can't do that now. Because in 20 years, we don't know where we're going to be. So, Matt is Carmen, right?
Yes.
Okay. We're kind of thinking we're good until 2021. So, you know, and honestly, if you're going for certification, trust me, it is really much easier just once you've reviewed the audio, the handouts, and the readings for the first term, just take the exam. Because if you put it off, it gets harder. You don't remember. And also, I mean, there are people who literally cross the street when they see us coming because they're embarrassed. Now, there's no reason to be embarrassed, because to be honest, we can't keep track of who's done what, where, when, why, you know, without our records. So, you're all adults. It's your choice. But if you're paying for certification, it's going to be a lot easier to just complete the first term, take the exam, and then the second term, submit your tape, third term, take the other exam, and be done. Because I'm telling you, people who, and I do, I have people right now who have submitted stuff from 5 years ago or more, it's harder and it's more annoying to you because, you know, you like, what, you know, what you have to re-review or whatever. I mean, just do it and be done with it.
No. Is that exam the same format as the post-test was?
No. That's a short answer. It takes longer. So it's not multiple choice.
Will it be online?
Yeah, it's online. But you will need to actually, I mean, we hope that you will actually need to think of it. So. Well, I was going to say, if you haven't decided whether you want to go for certification or not, that's fine. You don't have to make the decision now. But if you want to keep with, just finish this term and get it done, it's not too late. Shoot me an email or write me a note. Do not tell me in person. Anything you tell us verbally is gone. So if you decided you didn't pay initially, but you decided you want to do certification, just let us know by email or write a note, and we'll send you an invoice, and you can get the exam. But if you don't decide until later, and then you decide and pay, we'll give you the materials then. So we're
is
pretty
close. Is it $300
for that? Yes. And that's standard. There's no scholarships or discounts or anything.
Are we going to have like a window or a site that we go in and do the exam? Is this on a set day?
No. I'll send you a link, and you have until 2021.
Oh,
for sure. Probably longer, because with managed care and whatever, I don't know that we're going to actually retire. But we didn't want to commit, because back in the day, we told people, oh, anytime. And then they waited 20, I'm not joking, 20 years. No, that might be the record, and it might not be the record, because we've been teaching this for a long time. So we can't promise 20 years anymore, so we said 2021. But no, you can go in, and please read the instructions, because the instructions are clear, it's in your handouts, We ask you to prepare yourself and then sit down and do the exam in one sitting without any assistance and without referring to any materials. Because you've got to know, if you're going to do this stuff with clients, you need to know it well enough to do it. You can't really be sitting there and saying, okay, now excuse me one moment, let me look at my notes. Oh, yes, first thing is agenda, okay. Now I'll do agenda, you know, and you can't be referring to your notes or your colleagues when you're actually seeing patients. So we ask you to, you know, review the materials, do the readings. When you feel like you've mastered it and you're ready, sit, do it. And please use the name that you registered for the class in, because otherwise we can't find you. And if I get exams with initials or nicknames, I just assume it's an error and I automatically delete it because I can't figure out. I'm not going to try to figure out who it is. Okay. Good question.
Is it, for how long? Is it 1 hour or?
It's short answer until you finish it. But
okay.
It's not
limited by time.
No.
How many questions then?
I don't know. I haven't counted. But some are one answer and some are a paragraph. So
no, I know. Questions.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying there are a bunch. I don't know, 20, 25. I don't know. I haven't counted them. But I think you're certainly safe if you leave an hour. Whereas if anybody's done, has anybody here who wasn't here last, did anybody do the CE post test? That's a lot shorter. Mm-hmm. So that's 35 questions, but it's all multiple choice, so it's shorter. But we do ask you to do it in one sitting. So, you know, if you get interrupted and you go back and finish it later, that's okay. But if there are a lot of those, because we get, if you go into the test, it's submitted to us. If you put your name and then leave immediately, we get that exam. So if you're in and out and in and out, we're going to wonder if you're checking your material. So don't do that. Yeah, but we understand that things happen and interrupt connections. Okay, other administrative stuff? All right. So this afternoon, I'm going to start by talking about behavioral techniques. And people do get the idea, and you will constantly see studies comparing cognitive therapy and behavior therapy. This makes no sense whatsoever, because there is no such thing as a purely cognitive therapy. No one. The people who founded cognitive therapy, you know, Ellis had the sense to, or the savvy to, keep changing his name as he, I mean, he always did. He always included behavioral and emotional stuff, but as people kept confused, saying, oh, you just do thoughts, he added, you know, so it's rational, emotive, behavioral, you know, REBT. You don't sell books if you don't give your therapy a unique name. So Beck chose cognitive therapy, okay? If you look at his original works, they all include behavioral techniques. There is no cognitive without behavioral. So when people are comparing cognitive to behavioral therapy, what they're really doing is they're really comparing a cognitive technique to a behavioral technique, which is not good therapy. Cognitive therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy are not throwing individual techniques at huge groups of people. You design your treatment based on your conceptualization of the patient in the room with you, and you use a variety of techniques that make sense and that move them towards their goals and fit the conceptualization of why they're having their problems. So that doesn't mean you always, I mean, an array of clients. There are clients where I never do thought sheets at all, whole treatment. There are other clients where I never do behavioral stuff. There's no one magic. This is not a technique. This is an overall approach to thinking, conceptualizing, and treating your patient. But you need to be familiar with behavioral techniques because they are part of cognitive therapy, even though it's not in the title. I don't know exactly how. I wasn't around when he chose that title, and I honestly haven't asked him. I think it was even before they brought, because now cognitive behavioral therapy is the general term, and there are all kinds of treatments underneath it. And a lot of the people who say, oh no, we're not a cognitive behavioral treatment, actually are. Again, it's all about, making your own brand. And I'm fine with it. I mean, people need to sell books. But just understand, when I say it's not like behavioral stuff is added on or foreign, it's part and parcel. And if you read back, go to Beck's Cognitive Therapy of Depression from 1967, it's in there. Okay. So when you do use a behavioral technique in cognitive therapy, you have really, whether it's intentional or not, in all treatment, when you're using a behavioral technique, you end up with two purposes. One is, you're clearly hoping to change the behavior. But it also turns out that behavioral techniques and behavioral strategies are an excellent way to produce cognitive change. And what you're usually looking for when you use a behavioral technique is both. You want the person to make the change that you're recommending, but if you're doing it right, that will also end up changing their thinking, which will also end up changing their mood. So, there are multiple purposes. It's not just, we don't just do a behavioral technique to only change behavior. So, when you're going to use a behavioral intervention, you need to structure it so that you're clear with the patient about what you're trying to accomplish. You want to also set it up so that the client's likely to do it. And this is with any homework assignment. I covered some last time, but it's always good to repeat. You want it to be collaborative. You want them to understand why you're suggesting it. You want to really listen to their objections and concerns. It needs to be practical and manageable. And if you need to make sure they have the skills to do whatever you're asking them to do. And you really want to set things up so that people are likely to succeed. So there's no point in giving homework that the person is not going to follow through, or if they do, they're not going to succeed and not going to achieve the change that they're looking for and you're looking for. Now, when you use a behavioral technique, but you're also trying to get cognitive change, don't assume the patient will make those connections. So I have probably hundreds of examples, but one example that's very clear is patient, and now we're in this term, we're focusing on depression, although the principles apply to many disorders, but they had a patient who was depressed, and one of their cognitions was, I can't accomplish anything. Okay, then we pinpointed that thought. And part of their homework was, we set up an activity schedule and planned small steps for them to accomplish each day, okay? So they came back the next week, they had done their homework, they accomplished what they had set out to do each day. Now, part of my intent in setting the homework was to get them more active, to get them doing things, but also it was a way to test the thought, I can't do anything, I can't accomplish anything. When I meet with the patient, they said, yeah, they did their homework. But that doesn't mean they've changed the thought, I can't do anything. And so I would make a point to then say, so what does that So what have we learned about that thought, I can't do anything? And often, they're like, well, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, they don't get the connection. It seems obvious, and actually, when you use guided discovery, so many of the questions you'll be asking to guide them towards the answer seem crystal clear to you, okay? But that doesn't mean they're crystal clear to the patient. So it's good for them to answer. So really, if you're using, as you really should, if you're using a behavioral intervention to change a behavior, but also to change a thought, make sure you help the patient draw those conclusions. Well, you had the thought, I can't get anything done. Monday, you took out the trash. What does that tell you about the thought, I can't get anything done? And they might say, well, yeah, but that doesn't count. And then we can look at that thought. Okay? But don't assume they have gotten the cognitive piece if you haven't spelled it out. Okay? And research has been pretty consistent. Verbal disputation is one method of changing ideas and thoughts, and it's one of the weaker ones. Real change comes when people live differently, act differently. So we really want that behavioral component. We want to explore the thinking enough so that we know where their thinking's getting them in trouble. And yes, we want them looking at it and seeing how it's a problem and how they want to change it. But then to really make lasting change, we want them to go out and do things differently and not just in our office. If someone's not depressed in our office but depressed all the rest of the time, that's not really a successful treatment. Unless you want to live with them, which I really have problems with. We can talk. Now, when you have someone come in with severe depression, I mean the kind of person who really isn't doing much, lethargic, may have trouble and not be getting out of bed, with severe depression, it often makes sense to start with behavioral approaches rather and move to thought sheets later. Behavioral, looking at and challenging thoughts is pretty sophisticated. It doesn't have to be in writing. You don't have to be literate. Kids do great. But when you're severely depressed, it may be overwhelming. So one of the most versatile behavioral interventions is activity scheduling. And that is something we use a lot. You could call behavioral activation. There are all kinds of nice twists and turns about it. But basically, the activity scheduling is a behavioral technique that can be used in a myriad of ways. If someone's that depressed, getting them moving, getting them doing things, getting them possibly doing things they might actually enjoy is a great initial way to improve their mood enough so that they can engage in the cognitive work. So keep in mind, if the person's severely depressed, you may want to consider using activity scheduling rather than going right to cognitive work. And so if you look at, kind of as we go through with any technique, we'll take a look at Chris Podesty's decision tree for using all kinds of interventions. She does it for using her book, but it's great for any intervention. You know, do I have a conceptualization? Do I have Do I have a plan? Does the intervention match what the plan is? Does this make sense? I can't tell you how many people come and report to me. I ask everyone, you know, what was your previous therapy, what did you do? Most people, if they had homework, which most don't, you know, if they'll say, I didn't do anything, we just talked. But if they did do some things, and you ask them, so why were you doing that? Why were you doing fact sheets? Why were you, you know, and sometimes they'll come in, because some of the homework we have, in and of itself, is pretty crazy sounding, you know? Well, you know, I changed what tie I wore, you know, at work, and, you know, and out of the blue, it sounds like, okay, so in your therapy, you worked on your ties, right? and you say, so why were you doing that? Well, because my therapist told me to, you know. It needs to fit with their goals, your conceptualization. It needs to further the treatment. So, now, activity scheduling. All it is, if you look on page 27, this is Beck's standard. It's not perfect. You can get on your computer. You can make a better one. It doesn't include early morning. It clumps together the evening, whatever. Nothing magic, but basically it's a grid. An activity schedule is simply a grid that covers the days of the week and the hours of the day. Okay? Now, it can be used in hundreds of different ways. It can be used for assessment. And often it's a useful tool early in treatment just to collect data about something, whatever the patient's coming in with. We'll talk about this particular example later, but this was a depressed patient, and she was rating, so we were tracking her pleasure, okay? We were tracking pleasure from 0 to 10, and the activity she was doing and her pleasure. That's a simple way to get a look at what's going on in her week. But you can do, if the person's working on smoking, drinking, you know, yelling at their kids, you name it, you could, an early assignment could be to have them track their behavior or have them track their mood. They can rate pleasure, they could rate anxiety, they could rate anger, whatever you're targeting because of their goals and what you're working on. So it can be used just for assessment. Yes.
So you would use an something like that for assessment if you're suspecting, or if the depression is such big of an issue that client is having challenge getting through the day. Not with everyone. You wouldn't.
Now I don't use anything. I don't use anything with everyone except. Who can tell me what I use with everyone?
Agenda setter.
And what else?
Goals.
Yes. All right. Over the head, and you, yeah. Yes, and I do, and homework. I am very serious. Every single patient, you look at my notes. Agenda, goals, homework. Absolutely. Every single patient. But in terms of interventions, no. There are many people who come in, they're active, they're busy. They can still be depressed. And they may be working, like I said, on smoking or anxiety or anger, but it is a handy first homework or early homework assignment. Most people aren't going to be doing this all day, every once an hour, all week, every week for years, you know, I mean for the whole course of the treatment, but that's not to say some won't. But one method is to give you a picture. Because people will come in and they'll say how they feel, and I don't know, I really don't know what they're doing with their life and their day. So it's great for initial assessment. It's great to track something you're working on, how many times you went to the gym, you know, how many times you yelled at your kids. Or it can be used with depression. We often use it as an intervention to increase their activity level to improve their mood. And I'll tell you, it can be very effective with severe depression. And most people who are, or many people who are depressed, are not focusing at all on pleasure. They're beating themselves for not accomplishing enough or whatever. But the idea that actually having more fun is a great way to reverse the spiral of depression. And we'll talk more about how you frame it. But my initial point is just all many different ways you can use this. But it is really handy when you have a severely depressed patient and you want to get them starting doing something, and preferably something pleasurable. Now, we call it activity schedule. That doesn't mean we're scheduling what they do every hour in advance. There are some people where we do a planned schedule. Like if somebody's really disorganized or they're sleeping all day, and we might have a planned schedule where we actually get out of bed at a certain time each day and write it out, and then have a few things scheduled, and then have an actual schedule that they fill out in terms of what they really did, okay? So we sometimes use it as a plan, and then see how they actually follow through. But I never, ever schedule every hour of the day. That's just overkill. So it's a schedule, and it's a schedule, and usually you have people put a very one or two words of what they were doing just to kind of help see the patterns in your life. But we don't usually schedule what they do when, and never every minute. Yes?
You might be getting to this, but so with depressed patients, one of the challenges is they don't really get enjoyment from the things that they really enjoy,
yeah.
So you make them do it anyway.
Well, we will. I'm going to get to, how we actually use it. But the short answer is yes. But without the make them, we convince them.
Force them.
Beat them. Now, it's important that, and John's absolutely right. I mean, people don't come in saying, oh yeah, I really want to do X, so I'm going to do X. And they tend to be, they're depressed, they're self-punitive, and they focus on what they're accomplishing. And we do not, if we're planning, we plan the type of activity, not what's to be accomplished. So I would never have a plan of, and this one comes up a fair amount, complete dissertation or complete reference list for a paper. Instead, it would be to work on paper for 15 minutes. So to plan the activity, not the outcome. Okay? And not whether you enjoy it or not. To say, okay, enjoy X. That's a setup, right? But it's like, okay, what would happen, let's look at what would happen if you read a magazine anyway and just saw how it felt. So we're planning, if we're using it to plan, we're planning the type of activity. This form at the top says great activities, M for mastery and P for pleasure. Most people, it seems to me, probably not a coincidence, that most of the people who write the book are more compulsive than I am, and which is evidenced by the fact that after we wrote our book and a couple editions, we couldn't bear it any longer and stopped writing books. It's just too compulsive. You do not have to have people rate mastery and pleasure. I personally think at least Western society is way too focused on accomplishment. And most people who come in depressed are way too focused on accomplishment. And I'm much more interested in pleasure. I think people cheat themselves out of pleasure and enjoyment. And so I normally first to rate two things every hour? That's asking. I mean, it's hard enough to get people to write down something every hour. One thing is plenty in my book. So I focus almost always on pleasure and not accomplishment. You do not have to do both. And what I will do the first time, and where's my pen? There's not a marking pen, but there is. Okay. So what I'll do first, I'll give them this grid. And so let's say, certainly for depression, I'm likely to ask them to fill in each, and I'll tell them initially, this is for assessment at the beginning, right? I'll say, it'll save me a lot of time if I get a sense of your week. And so rather than just try to walk through Monday, Tuesday, which you're not going to remember, nobody would, if you could help track just one simple word of what you're doing, each hour over the week, and how much pleasure you're getting from that, how much you're enjoying it. And by the way, some of it's just the way you can wrap your head around something. I never have people track how depressed they feel. They don't need more focus on their depression, thank you. On the other hand, with anxiety, I do have people rate how anxious they are, because somehow rating how relaxed you feel, they could go the whole week and say they're zero relaxed every day. That doesn't give you much information. So you have to use your head in terms of what, anger. I do have people rate how angry they are, not how, what's the opposite of angry?
How happy.
Well, I don't know, because happy could be sad. I don't know, not angry. That doesn't, But say for depression, the first time, I'll give them the sheet, and then I'll draw the scale, and I'll say we're rating pleasure 0 to 10, and I will explain. I'll say 5 is, and I'll write it out for them because they'll forget. 5 is completely neutral. For most people, that might be brushing your teeth or something that's not good, it's not bad, it just is. Okay? 0 is agony, the worst you felt. And I'm just the worst, the most depressed you've ever been. And I might ask them, can you think of a time when you were bottom? That might be a 0, or a little bit up from a 0. And 10 is going to be ecstasy. Extreme, joy. And I tell them, we know you're depressed. I'm not expecting tons of tens. This is, we understand. And the idea is just to use your own scale, use your own sense of what's this hour like. And then I will I'll give them the form in the room and ask them to fill in a couple of boxes. I'll say, so right now, you're in therapy. So for this box, and let's find Saturday at 2 o'clock, okay? So you'd put therapy or class. And I'll tell them, because I try to use my own, measly humor. I'll say, don't worry about hurting my feelings. If you had to rate this hour, I can take it. Where would you put right this hour? How much are you enjoying this session, 0 to 10? And have them, put the number. And what were you doing before you got here? Well, maybe they were driving to the session, so we put driving. And what was that like for you? And so I make sure, and I have them write it down, so that I make sure they have the basic concept of looking at each hour and just thinking about, okay, how much did I enjoy that? Okay? And I tell them, I'm just trying to get a picture of your week. So when they come in, and of course, I'll ask them like any other homework assignment. It's like, can you see why I'm asking? Or I'll say to them, why am I asking you to do this? and hopefully they can answer. And I'll warn them, it's annoying to have, you have to stick it in your purse or your pocket. It's going to be a lot more useful if you try to do it throughout the day rather than looking back at the whole day. Who can remember how they felt driving to therapy once it's 10 o'clock at night? You can pull it out. If you're concerned about privacy, you can use it, do it in the restroom. You can scribble it on, And so I try to talk through. And then I'll ask, and what's my favorite question that I'll ask before I send them home with it?
What's going to keep you from doing this?
Yes, very good. What's going to stop you? Well, it does seem annoying. Well, privacy, and then solve those problems, Because they're thinking them, or they will think of them if you don't problem solve. But say they bring in. Now, this was a young woman who was very depressed. This is on page 27. She brought this in. And so what I do, first of all, when they come in, we'll look at it together, and I can learn so much from one activity schedule. So she's rating pleasure. She was very, very depressed. She rated herself as, zero, or just, life is miserable. She was a grad student, and it was the summer, so she was not in classes, so she was not actively in classes or working at the time she filled this out. And, she was like, everything's black. And she also, coincidentally, had just become engaged to be married. Okay? So as you glance at this, and we're looking 0 to 10 of pleasure, what kinds of patterns do you notice right off the bat? What can you learn? She hands this to you, and this is the first thing I'm going to ask the client, do they see any patterns? And often they won't. It's amazing. They can fill out the whole week and have no perspective whatsoever. But as you look, what interesting things do you notice, and what would you want to ask her more about from this activity schedule?
She should go to Cedar Point more.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So she actually enjoyed going to Cedar Point, and I would ask her who she went with, and so I'd ask her about that. Okay. What else?
Wedding is a 3.
Look through each day. Very interesting. Turns out, yes, wedding plans, a 3. And it turned out when I look at, because that's one of the things I'm going to look at, I'm going to look at the lows and the highs. Turns out all the lowest numbers were when she was either planning the wedding, telling people about the wedding, or with her fiancé.
Oh boy.
Now, was she telling me that when I asked her about her fiancé and her engagement? Absolutely not. Very, very interesting. Absolutely worth it. And I'm going to want to say, for example, Thursday, she's golfing. It's a 6. It's my, for a depressed person, I'm delighted with a 6, Most people want better than 6, but as a depressed person, by the way, if I asked her in advance, she would have told me the whole week would have been 2s and 3s, And actually so golfing on Thursday was a 6. Funny thing, golfing on Sunday was a 3. And so I asked her, so what was the difference? I was with my friends on Thursday, and I was with my fiancé on Sunday. Okay? What else? This is the kind of stuff. The beauty, what I love about guided discovery, is it's not me making arbitrary, if you're in your big authoritative chair, and you say, I wonder if you have issues of, commitment issues, or what, if you're concerned about commitment or whatever, and they're kind of like, who are you and where'd that come from? But I'm looking at it, the proof's in the pudding. I'm just asking. And all of a sudden, it's like, so you had a great time with your friends and a 3 with your fiance. Oh, wedding plans were a 3. and the patterns emerge without me having to be the authoritarian telling her what she's feeling. What else do we see or want to know about?
She enjoys eating with her friends.
Yeah, she actually even, there's one place here where she's doing chores with a friend, and it's a positive, or at least neutral. You know, she really is, you know, one of the patterns that emerged. I mean, on Monday, with doing chores with Kathy was a 7. That was more fun than the golf. Okay?
Planning the wedding.
And definitely than planning the wedding. And eating with Kathy on Wednesday was an 8. And so when, you know, and the truth is that she had been, like many depressed people, she had been avoiding social activity and had not been, because she wasn't in class, she wasn't working, she'd gotten more isolated. And when she was spending time, as long as it wasn't the fiancé, she was felt better when she was with friends. What else would you want to know about? Or, you know, or what strikes you?
On Wednesday, all the way 8 to 12 p.m., meeting 8 to, what does that mean?
And that's exactly what I would say. Whoa, interesting. Meeting 8 to. Turns out she was a recovering alcoholic. She was at an AA meeting. And there were some pieces of it that were very affirming and that she really felt positive about. And there were other pieces that felt really, really, probably partly when she had told people she was getting married. And so that gives me an entree to ask about those meetings and those people. And, I mean, just this one little assignment to get the level of information that I got with a few minutes reviewing this assignment with her could have taken me ages in just an open-ended, how was your week? Okay? And so it gives you, and there's, we could spend, I mean, really, with any, if you take a good hard look at any activity schedule, you're going to find lots of things to clarify, ask about. Plus, this gave us a basis for beginning to look at some homework assignments. It was pretty, this was a bright woman, but she was quite depressed. We looked and it's like, okay, when you're with your friends, you're feeling much better. We've already discussed how the spiral of depression works and activities and, you know, doing things that feel good help move it, you know, less depressed, and being isolated makes it more depressed, and you enjoy being with your friends. So I could say to her, what would be a good homework assignment for you this week? And she could tell me, well, it sounds like it would be good for me to spend more time with my friends and make a point of doing that. So it's a great way to begin to look at a homework assignment. Now, I noticed, this is very early, right? I'm just assessing. I noticed very clearly, point out, we just, you know, mentioned this whole wedding fiancé thing. I do not say to her, okay, obviously when you're dealing with the wedding and the fiancé, you're miserable, so dump the guy. I'm not going to do that. I am, at this point, I'm tagging that for a lot of further discussion and exploration. But actually, at this stage, just getting her to commit to spending more time with friends and was plenty. And it, believe me, she noted, I mean, as we talked, you know, she was noticing the whole fiancé thing, and the stage was set to talk about that a lot further. But it was way too early to make any drastic pronouncements about that. Yes.
So at the end of it, would you synthesize everything or make some kind of things to work on? How would you end this?
Well, what I would preferably do is to, we've been discussing it, and I'd ask her, so what did you take from this? what did we learn from this assignment? And what, and that, I do exactly what I just said. And I'd say, so, does that give us some ideas? Does that give you some ideas about what might be a good homework assignment for you to work on this week? And then she can, you know, preferably, if I can get the patient to synthesize, if I can get the patient to suggest and come up, and sometimes what they come up with is horrible. There's a fabulous, maybe I should record it and share it with class. It just occurred to me. There's a British comedian, nobody knows him, but really he's fabulous. His name is John Finnemore. He does radio comedy, and he does a skit. He's not a therapist, he's a comedian, right? But he does a skit of a therapy session where this woman is in a horribly abusive relationship with an absolutely terrible person, and she's broken apart from him. And, I mean, he's like criminal level, violent, whatever, you know. And so he's kind of discovering. And so he says, well, so last time you went, so what happened last time you went back to him? Well, he beat me. I ended up in the emergency. Okay, and the time before that, he beat me. You know, so what does that tell you? And then she said, well, maybe I should give it another try. And he kept trying to get her to, so, I mean, it's a parody of Guided Discovery. It's really very, very funny. But, I mean, obviously, if there's something that big a disconnect, you have to talk about that directly. But if you can use, for most people, when you guide them and have them look straightforwardly, they actually, you know, their reality is not that different from your reality. And she was totally on board with spending more time with friends, and then we could gradually, over the next few sessions, begin to look at her fears. And it really turned out, it wasn't that the fiancé was a terrible person or anything. She was terrified of commitment and the idea of being trapped in a relationship, and we were able to address that directly. But so that's how I would, and it might take just, sometimes it's just a few minutes, sometimes it's the whole session, sometimes I'm going to want to ask them to do more, sometimes I don't. The next page is a different approach. You don't need the formal grid. Jim just draws lines on pieces of paper, works just as well. He did have this guy writing, this was a college professor, very achievement-oriented, and he just wasn't valuing enjoyment. So Jim had him rating enjoyment and accomplishment, okay? Enjoyment was on the left, accomplishment on the right. And this guy was like, bright guy, but boy, when depression's so powerful, it distorts everything. So when asked about his week prior to the assignment, he's like, everything miserable, I'm in agony every minute, every day. When asked to track it by the hour, he's like, well, I can tell you right now, it's going to be zeros the whole time. He does this, okay, and he has eights, nines, you know. He has some low numbers, but not even, you know, not even horribly low. But, you know, and then, this is not unusual. He hands it to Jim, and Jim asks, so, you know, what'd you think about the assignment? He said, well, you can see, I'm in agony the whole week. He couldn't even, and that became very, very useful to know, and it is true. When studies have shown consistently, when you're really depressed, you remember and retain the negative. And the positive goes out the window. So this guy needed a lot of help. He had to be continually revisiting, looking, processing, saying, wait, what happened, you know, what was that hour like? That intro class was an intro class. Oh my God, has anybody here taught intro classes? These are not my idea.
No.
Nobody wants to be there. It was, you know, on Friday, his intro class lecture was a 9 for accomplishment, a 9 for enjoyment. But that tells you a lot about what his issues are. It's not that he, I mean, sure, some of it is he could be doing more pleasurable activities, but also he was not retaining. He was only remembering the bad. And so then we could work directly to help come up with reminders, reviews, and, you know, and a strategy that made sense to him for how to make it live in the moment. Yes.
So I'm imagining, like, being a professor. I live in a university town, so I come across a lot of perfectionism tendency. Looking at it, seeing 6, 7, pretty bad, because they have such a high standard. Look at me. Like you said, he said, I'm miserable. It's
right.
Only 6, 7.
And that's where you might need to begin to help him look at, well, wait, what does a 6, 7 mean? What does it mean? I mean, you know, and again, if you just pounce and interpret, people tune you out. So if you take a guy, and he was totally perfectionistic, and if you take a guy like this and say, well, you realize, you know, it looks to me like your perfectionism is getting in your way, he's like, what perfectionism? I'm a loser. And they absolutely deny it. So you, but if you have them look, well, it's interesting. You know, on Friday you had this class, and you put at the time that you, enjoyed and accomplished at a 9. Can you remember that, and actually work with it. Can you remember that class? When you're looking at the week, what happened to that class? Or what happened to this piece and that piece? Or what does that mean to you? What is the 6 and 7 mean? I mean, you can, the thing is, it gives you something concrete to run with that's coming from them, not you. So there are all kinds of different ways to use this. And you can then, again, and you know, for him, I would end up with a very different homework assignment than I might with the prior girl, woman. You know, I might, you know, with her, she didn't need to really do the actual formal activity schedule for very long. She got doing more social stuff, more engaged in other things, and went directly to looking at her relationship with her fiancé and what was going on there. With him, you know, I might work on some strategies to keep doing activity schedules and looking, but also then review during the day, you know, look at how he discounts the positive and minimizes, and, you know, it's going to go a totally different path. So, in general, with depression, we're going to want to try to increase the person's activity level and preferably pleasure. And why? I mean, I think early in the treatment, the research is pretty clear that, you know, the spiral works, that people, you know, we don't have to argue which came first, thoughts, feelings, or behaviors, but as the person gets more depressed, they tend to do fewer things that are satisfying. They look at themselves and say, see, I couldn't even enjoy that. Look at how depressed I am. So their thoughts are very negative. And then they feel more depressed, and then they do even less and say, look how depressed I am, and it spirals downward from there. So if we can change the thoughts, the moods, or with activities, change some of the behavior, it actually can make a difference. And it really can be much easier for people to wrap their heads around and actually follow through with in the beginning if they're seriously depressed than the cognitive work, which is a little more abstract. And often there is enough of a mood change early on that they can move to the a higher level, you know, or a cognitive piece in not too long. If people will say, well, there's no point, I'm always depressed. We try not to just argue with people and say, well, you couldn't possibly be always equally, No, you're not always depressed. Remember last year? No. It's like, well, you know, I understand you're in a lot, you know, you use a lot of empathy, you're in a lot of pain. Here's how you spin it to get them to look at it. It's like, but are there any times when you're even more depressed than others? And most people were like, yes, I always feel lousy, but there are times when it's even worse. And this is going to give me a picture of your week. One of the things we're going to want, if we're going to try to help them increase positive activities or pleasure, don't wait until the last minute of the session and say, well, as you can see, you're not doing a lot of fun stuff, so go do more fun stuff. You know? I mean, you laugh, but it's so common, even when people submit their tapes, that they stick the homework in the last 2 minutes, and the person, you know, that you give a really depressed patient that assignment. You know, go out and do more pleasurable stuff. They go home, and it's like, I don't enjoy anything. There's nothing I can do. I'm even a failure at therapy. I'm not going to be able to do my homework. There's no point going back. And you've just helped make them more depressed. So to do that, you have to have enough time in the session to help them find positive activities that are worth trying. And I always, so they'll say, because it's true, when you're depressed, things are not as much fun. And I'm going to explain the spiral and say, we're not expecting it to be as much fun. It's actually an experiment. We're just looking at what happens and what your week looks like when you're what you've been doing, and if we add in some more things that at least at one point were enjoyable, and just let's just see what, you know, and we can just see what happens. And I'll ask them, I'll say, well, you know, you've tried it your way. How well is that working? There is research to show that the less depressed people do, and the less they move their muscles even, the more depressed they get. So you've tried it your way. Would it be worth giving it a try? Even if you're really convinced, and you may be right. We have one way to find out. Would you be willing to at least give it a try? And people really, I mean, they're coming to you because they're hoping for some help. And so they might not be optimistic, but if you believe, you got to believe in your approach, by the way. If you don't buy it, you will never get people to do it. And I think a lot of times when people say, well, I can't get my patients to follow through, a lot of it is they may have mixed feelings about it or not really. It's kind of like, you know, selling a used car. You got to believe it. I mean, I'm really pumped about my approach, and I've seen a bazillion people by now. So I sell it. I'm not saying to everybody, believe me, but if I get excited about an intervention and I think it's right for this person, I often can sell it to them. Yes?
Well, I want to ask at this point, before we close, so tell me, what do you enjoy? Is there anything, just tell me one thing that you like. Do you like getting up? Do you like going to sleep? No? Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that? Mm-hmm.
What I'd rather, okay, you know what, I am going to move right after break.
Okay.
I am going to talk about how do you help them develop a list. That's
okay.
The next
That's
step.
Right.
Because I don't know, did anybody, what did you people, it wasn't bad, but I could see somebody saying, you're not listening. Mm-hmm. I don't enjoy anything.
Okay.
There is nothing. I used to enjoy stuff, but now I'm talking. Do you have a hearing impairment or something?
No,
some
I understand
of these people,
what you're saying.
Some
yes.
of these people
are really depressed.
They're really depressed, and they're also, let's face it, it's no fun being depressed. So a lot of them are angry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
And they have gotten a lack of understanding from many people in their life. People are just like, well, why don't, and you don't want to sound like, well, why don't you just go spend more time with friends? Do you see the difference when the first lady said, wow, you know, my mood really is better when I'm with friends. I guess I need to spend more time with friends rather than, oh, you're depressed. You need to spend more time with friends. You know, it feels very different. Yes.
Quick question. So you get a person to do something, and they start doing it. So they come back and they say, yeah, they did it. But then the next week they come in, and like you want to like sort of kind of like add on to what they
oh, yeah.
Done. So they come in the next week, and it seems like when they realize that they had a good time, then the next week they come in, oh, I can't do it.
Well, so then you see, if you've gotten them to do some things and they're feeling a little better, then you can look at the thoughts. Because you know what? Feeling better can be a scary thing. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. And yeah, and that's where you get to the thoughts and feelings. Because mm-hmm. it's like, well, wait a second. If I feel better, people are going to expect more of me.
Right.
And I'll have to go out right. to, I'll have to go back to work. So I'm talking about the initial just getting them to start doing some things. That's not the end of the treatment. And then you can look at, well, wait a second, and you can just do exactly that. You can say, that's interesting. Week one, you spent more time with your friends and you were feeling better. Week two, you chose not to. Let's look at a moment in time when you could have gone out with Susie and you called her and said no. Let's look at those thoughts and feelings. And that's where we can get in and get in there and do the work. This is just laying the groundwork. This is getting the mood jiggled enough so that you can get in it. And I'll tell you, because the proof I love, because it's not me trying to figure things out. It's God. They're telling me. And, you know, to be honest, I'm doing guided discovery, and I think I'm going over here. And it turns out the reality is over here. And that's okay. Because I was wrong. But I don't have to be right. I don't even have to be brilliant, although I like being brilliant, you know. It's always a plus if I can do it. But I don't have to be guessing. They're going to tell me. And then I'm going to be puzzled, like, well, wait. This felt better, but you did this. Let's look at what happened, because every time people do something, there was a decision made, even if the decision was not to make a decision. Somehow, there was thoughts, there were feelings, and there were actions. And we can get in there and look at it. And in the meantime, we can get out and have a little break.